Tunisia's president appoints a new interior minister several days after seizing control of the government and freezing the parliament. The World Trade Organization warns that global disparities in coronavirus vaccine rates could impact worldwide economic recovery. Also ahead, Brazil reports more than 42,000 new coronavirus cases and over 1,300 additional deaths in a 24-hour time span. Welcome to World News from our headquarters in the reigning capital, Tehran. It's great to have you with us. Our top story, the Tunisian president has appointed former National Security Advisor Rida Garsalawi to run the Interior Ministry. Qais Said also pledged to implement the constitutional text and safeguard the people's rights and freedoms. On Sunday, the president dismissed the government and suspended the parliament for a month. Said said he made the move to save his country from corruption and plots to sow civil strife amid a surge in misgovernance, faltering economy, and a spiraling COVID-19 outbreak. Tunisians are awaiting the appointment of a new prime minister and the announcement of a plan to end the political and economic crisis in the country. The World Trade Organization has warned that global disparities in coronavirus vaccine rates could impact worldwide economic recovery. The WTO chief Ngozi Okonjo-Iweala said the failure to ensure global access to vaccines poses a serious threat to the world's economy. She especially warned about the case for low-income countries where barely over 1% of the population has received even one dose. The International Monetary Fund also issued a similar warning on Tuesday, saying vaccine access emerged as the principal fault line along which the global recovery splits into two blocks. Political commentator Jack Rasmus says if rich countries do not contribute to vaccine distribution in the world, COVID-19 will stick around for longer, further damaging their economies.
Vaccines are pretty much manufactured in the developed countries here, so a lot of countries are totally dependent on receiving the vaccines. And there's a big responsibility to do that, to make sure you have enough production and it gets distributed. Not all countries that have vaccines are really stepping up to that responsibility, you know, and it'll come back to haunt them. The longer we don't have the whole world vaccinated, the more likely you're going to get new and more virulent strains. Right now, of course, this Delta strain's pretty serious, more contagious, but if you don't get everybody vaccinated, then you're going to have mutations, and maybe the next one will be sufficient to negate the effects of the vaccines themselves. So it's very serious that the whole world isn't getting vaccinated fast enough. Of course, some of these countries, you know, they're almost failed states, and their governments are not really even capable, if they had the vaccines, of getting them distributed. But that's a secondary problem. The main problem is if you don't get the vaccines, then the longer this goes on, the more likely you're going to get even more serious strains of this virus.
The United Kingdom has registered over 31,000 new daily coronavirus infections, raising its total confirmed cases to more than 5,700,000. The daily infections saw a jump compared to the 27,000 reported on Wednesday. The country also recorded 85 new fatalities, bringing the overall death toll to nearly 130,000. Government data shows that the number of cases has risen for a second day in a row following 7 days of decline. The UK eased all curbs on July 19th, despite a rise in new cases at levels not seen since mid-January. The move has been criticised by international experts. A new World Health Organization report says the United States has registered the highest number of new COVID-19 cases globally in the last week. The report stated that the US logged over 500,000 infections for the week ending July 25th. That's a 131% increase compared to the week prior. The spike comes as the Delta variant continues to spread across the globe. The vaccination rates have also slowed in the US, More than 34 million Americans have been infected with COVID-19 and nearly 612,000 deaths recorded so far in the US. The total number of cases worldwide could surpass 200 million in the next 2 weeks if the trend continues. Brazil, meanwhile, has recorded over 42,000 daily COVID-19 infections and more than 1,300 fatalities. The figures bring the country's total confirmed cases to more than 19.8 million and the death toll to over 554,000. The Latin American nation has been grappling with the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States. Meanwhile, Mexico logged over 19,000 new cases and 381 deaths. The country has so far reported more than 2.8 million cases and just shy of 240,000 deaths. Mexico's National Statistics Institute, however, estimates the death toll from the respiratory disease to be 35% higher than the official figures. Iran has started vaccinating prisoners all across the country. The move is part of a vaccination program targeting priority groups. As the Mankajuri reports, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
On the occasion of the Eid al-Qadir, Iran has officially begun vaccinating prisoners across the nation against the COVID-19 virus. Speaking at the vaccination ceremony, Iran's deputy health minister said that in view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days.
In view of the existing capacity and availability of vaccines, all prisoners will receive the first dose of vaccines in the next 10 days. Thanks to the proper observation of health protocols by prisoners, the average number of people infected with the virus in prisons has been less than ordinary people.
In the past couple of days, with the imports of foreign-made vaccines and the entry of domestically produced vaccines into the vaccination basket of the country, the pace of vaccination process has increased to the extent that, according to the Iranian health minister, the country has set a record of vaccinating over 430,000 people on a single day.
In the occasion of the auspicious Eid al-Qadir, we have begun vaccinating all prisoners across the country. To vaccinate all prisoners and those working at prisons, we need over 200,000 doses of vaccines. This amount has already been supplied and the vaccination process for prisoners will continue as planned. At today's ceremony at Evin Prison, in Tehran, 250 prisoners were among the first to receive the jabs.
Moreover, centers for drive-in vaccination across the country have been established and they have played a major role in the increase in the daily vaccination rate. Iran is using a combination of locally produced vaccines and imported foreign-made vaccines in its national vaccination program. According to Iranian health officials, the country's homemade coronavirus vaccines develop immunity against the new mutations of the virus.
According to Iran's health ministry, almost 60 million Iranians will be vaccinated against the virus by the end of the current Iranian year in March 2022 using domestically produced and foreign-made vaccines. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
The outgoing administration of Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has met with Iran's leader, who had some observations regarding its performance, especially on the nuclear deal. The leader's statements spelled an air of pessimism about whether the talks would be successful or not. He said the next administration should not repeat the mistakes made by the current one.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that one key lesson for future administrations to learn from the experience gained during the tenure of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani is that there is no benefit in putting one's trust in the West. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the members of President Rouhani's administration. He said it was manifested during the tenure of this administration that nothing can be gained from putting one's trust in the West. The leader added that domestic programs should in no way be tied to Western states under any circumstances due to the proven failure of such an approach.
Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's regional role have nothing to do with the original JCPOA or United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. They are simply irrelevant. And so to the extent that the United States continues to attempt to utilize maximum pressure to bring in irrelevant issues such as ballistic missiles and Iran's regional role, I believe that we will very soon reach this impasse and that the Raisi administration will bring an end to this charade in Vienna.
Making a reference to the ongoing talks in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ayatollah Khamenei acknowledged that endeavors made by Iranian diplomats, saying, however, that Americans insisted on their hostile stance against Iran and did not move even one step forward during the talks. The leader denounced the U.S. attempts to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues. He said by adding such a clause, the Americans are seeking to gain an excuse for further meddlesome acts regarding Iran's missile program and regional issues.
If the talks in Vienna aren't already at an impasse, I believe that this is where we're going to be heading very soon if the United States continues to refuse to return to its responsibilities and its obligations under the agreement and instead attempts to utilize the illegal terrorist sanctions and maximum pressure campaign of the Trump regime in Vienna to acquire leverage over Iran in the negotiations, specifically regarding issues that have nothing to do with the JCPOA.
Ayatollah Khamenei drew attention to the fact that the U.S. has refused to provide Iran with a guarantee that it will not violate its commitments again. He noted that Washington will not shy away from violating its contractual commitments in the same manner that it did in 2018, a move that was completely costless for them.
Much of the topics covered by Iran's leader were on the performance of President Hassan Rouhani and his administration. One of the views he expressed was that the outgoing administration's experience proved that putting trust in the West did not work. He also referred to how the U.S. attempted to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues like its missile program or regional activities.
Six rounds of negotiations have been held so far in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the Iran nuclear deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action with the JCPOA. 3 years ago, the U.S., under former President Donald Trump, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and branded what it called the Maximum Pressure Campaign against Iran. Now President Joe Biden, who was the Vice President of the United States when the deal was inked, has promised to re-enter the JCPOA and abandon Trump's failed Maximum Pressure Campaign.
Iran's position on the JCPOA and international law has been clear and consistent since the signing of the JCPOA in 2015. And so as such, I don't believe that an incoming Raisi administration or frankly any new incoming Iranian presidential administration would handle the current talks and negotiations any differently.
But so far, he's practically followed footsteps of his predecessor. President-elect Ebrahim Raisi will be officially sworn in on August 5th. Raisi won the June 18 presidential election in a landslide victory, garnering over 18 million votes. It's widely believed that the foreign policy in Iran has a well-established and large-scale framework. When it comes to the issue of the Vienna talks, Iran's policies are not going to change. Therefore, no fundamental changes are expected in the negotiation process under the next administration. However, analysts believe the next administration needs to bolster the national position of Iran to successfully counter the bullying stance of the U.S. and its allies.
Israeli soldiers kill a Palestinian man attending the funeral of a 12-year-old boy slain by regime forces in the occupied West Bank. The 20-year-old Shawkat Khalid Awad was fatally shot in the town of Beit Omar near the city of El Khalid, also known as Hebron. The incident occurred after Israeli soldiers attacked mourners at the funeral of Mohammed Muayyad Al-Alami. The boy was killed on Wednesday when Israeli forces opened fire at the car he was riding in. Palestinian media described the attack as unprovoked. Earlier, we were joined by our West Bank correspondent, Muna Kandil, who gave us more details about the Israeli forces' attack against the Palestinian mourners.
Palestinians were taking part in the funeral processions of Mohammed Al-Alami. Israeli forces opened fire at the mourners, fired stun grenades, rubber-coated bullets in order to disperse the mourners. They don't want this huge number of people taking part in the funeral processions. A Palestinian was shot in the abdomen as well as in the neck. 20-year-old Shawkat Awad from Beit Umar. Several hours later, he succumbed to his injuries. And we are speaking about 10 more Palestinians were wounded during these clashes. The clashes continued for hours.
Palestinian resistance group Hamas has sent a letter to the African Union slamming its decision to grant Israel an official observer status at the Continental Organization. The head of Hamas's political wing, Ismail Haniyeh, sent a letter to the chairman of the African Union Commission, Moussa Faki, saying the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union towards the Palestinian cause. The African Union handed Israel the observer status on Thursday, citing the regime's help to the continent in its battle against the coronavirus pandemic. That brings an end to our news bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
New research suggests coronavirus could have been in Italy in October 2019, but is not conclusive. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Donato Paolo Mancini, reporter. This article is published under the heading Italian Blood Samples Revive Debate Over First Signs of COVID in Europe. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Renewed tests of blood samples collected in Italy as early as October 2019 have revived a debate over whether coronavirus was circulating in Europe before Chinese authorities confirmed the first case in Wuhan. Scientists from Milan's Istituto Nazionale Tumori, a cancer research center, wrote in a new paper published recently that retesting of a small number of pre-pandemic blood samples by two labs had indicated the presence of antibodies normally observed after coronavirus infections. The result of this retesting suggests that what we previously reported in asymptomatic patients is a plausible signal of early circulation of the virus in Italy, Giovanni Apollone, one of the researchers, told the Financial Times. He said, if this is confirmed, this could explain the explosion of symptomatic cases observed in Italy. SARS-CoV-2, or an earlier version, circulated silently under the surface. Italian researchers originally screened 959 individuals for lung cancer before the pandemic. Last year, they tested the samples again, looking for coronavirus-linked antibodies and said they had found traces of infection. At the request of the World Health Organization, those samples were retested by the Vis Medeiros lab in Siena, Italy, and a WHO-affiliated facility at Erasmus University in the Netherlands. Marion Koopmans, head of virology at Erasmus, said the new results were interesting. However, she cautioned that while there was some evidence of antibodies, none of the samples provided conclusive proof of prior infection with COVID-19, based on the university's strict criteria. We use a rather stringent threshold and cannot rule out that some of the observed reactivity is real, she says. However, for confirmation of earlier circulation, we would recommend studies of patients with unexplained illness for virological confirmation. The labs retested 29 of the original Italian samples, some positive and some negative, along with 29 control cases from 2018. From these tests, three samples were found by both Erasmus and Vis Medeiros to be positive for a type of coronavirus-linked antibody, IgM, that typically indicates recent infection. The earliest was collected on October 10, 2019. One of the samples from February 5, 2020 was also positive for so-called neutralizing antibodies. However, none of the samples contained high enough levels of each of the three types of antibodies that Erasmus requires to be considered proof of infection. IgM neutralizing antibodies and a third antibody known as IgG, and in another nine samples that Vis Medeiros said were positive for infection. Levels of IgM antibodies were below the cutoff points set by Erasmus. Gabriella Zosi, one of the Italian researchers, said. Zosi argued that in the pre-pandemic period, the virus may have been less aggressive or contagious, which made it necessary to use highly sensitive tests despite the risk of finding false positive cases. Koopman said Erasmus University's stringent criteria were necessary to conclusively state whether the pandemic started earlier than currently thought. That does not mean it is impossible, she said, just that you would like to see other pieces of evidence. The Italian paper, which has not been peer-reviewed, did not address the question of where the novel coronavirus originated, but the findings are likely to stoke the debate over whether COVID-19 was circulating in Italy or elsewhere before the first confirmed case in Wuhan in December 2019. Other studies have placed the first cases in Europe as early as November 2019, including one in Milan. The WHO said it was not part of the lab analysis and that the results highlighted the challenge of conducting antibody tests on samples from 2019. It said it was grateful to scientists trying to advance the understanding of the origins of COVID-19.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Roundtable from Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality, brought to you by the one and only IRB English Radio. In the studio with me, I have the pleasure and honor of hosting two wonderful guests. To my left is
Muzaffar Haider from the UK.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, bro.
Wa alaikum salam.
Thank you for joining us. And to the right of the ring,
Hassanain from India. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you so very much, you guys, for being with us. We all have people in our lives, right? Obviously. Like, even the most introverted, isolated hermit in the universe still has somebody.
Yeah, there's very few people who are completely isolated from
humanity.
Completely
isolated. I envy them. Anyway.
They usually go crazy. They actually go insane, right? They just start babbling and stuff. Humans can't survive without interaction.
That's true. That's actually true. Right? And then there are a group of people. My focus today is mainly on the second group. We'll lead to that. That we wish we had in our lives. The plot thickens. Who are the most significant people in your life?
The people around me, like, you know, my family, my friends.
Definitely.
Yeah, they're the most significant people in my life.
Right.
And my teachers. The people I don't have physically are the most significant people. Ahlul Bayt.
Ah, very true, very true.
Alayhim as-salam.
Alayhim as-salam. How do you think your interaction, would you say that you have a healthy relationship with these people that you've mentioned?
Yeah.
How do you define healthy? Like, what do you do in order to maintain that healthy relationship?
Well, like, my family, like I daily talk to my father, my mother, and my siblings. Like, we talk on the phone. Like, it's no issues in our, you know, relationship. It's a good relationship.
Mm.
And the friends I meet are my roommates.
Yeah, what do you do to show them that you value this relationship? If you value it at all. Do you value this relationship?
Yes, I do. Like, we help each other.
Uh-huh. Help each other in what sense?
You cook for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, I knew it. You cook for them, don't you? You cook
That's
some cool. Hedramati.
I love it.
That's awesome. That's really awesome. I feel ridiculous because I don't cook, but that's awesome. Good for you. And for, like, your family, now that they're so far away from you,
yeah,
and you can't cook for them anymore, obviously, how do you maintain that relationship with them? How do you tell them, how do you let them know that you cherish this relationship that you have?
Okay, so, like, you know, living, like, thousands of kilometers away from them, so it's, like, still, you know, I know that we are still living in the same world. Like, I contact them daily, I ask them, like, how are they, you know, the greetings and everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk to them daily.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I do it.
I talk to my boss daily. Doesn't mean I like him.
Yeah, but it's different, right? Like, you talk out of love.
How is that out of love talk?
We care for each other.
Right. How do you cherish them?
I don't cherish them as much as I should cherish them.
So you feel there's things that you should do, you should have done differently?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But it's different for different people, right? So, for example, your spouse, you need to do certain things to make them feel appreciated and loved and cared for and all that. And then with friends, there's such a diverse kind of spectrum of needs when it comes to friends. Some are more needy than others. Some of them, you need to give them more time, otherwise they'll break down and start crying.
True.
Some of them are tougher, and you need to give them some tough love sometimes. It really does.
Or they're the one giving you the love so you don't break down.
Yeah, vice versa. It works the other way around as well.
Do you wish there were people in your life you could replace?
Yeah, I do.
You do, right?
No. Yes. Not replace, but I'd like them to be there, but maybe like in the corner a bit more, and somebody else becomes more prominent, you know?
That somebody else that's already within your life?
No.
Ah, someone new. Add a new character to the plot.
Yeah. Some new interesting character.
What is it about that person that makes you feel they were less visible? You wish they were more marginalized?
Life is a search for perfection, as they say, right? So we're not just searching for that perfection in ourselves. We're actually searching for it in people around us. And so you love people, but then you see certain flaws, and you don't have hopes of those flaws being extinguished, and therefore you feel like you need to move on, and you're like, you know, where is that person who doesn't have these flaws? And it keeps on going like that until eventually...
I think we feel like that the most with our relatives, don't you think? Because our relatives are there already. They were there when we came.
No, not necessarily.
And then they got these certain flaws, but you got to love them anyway.
No.
And
you got to
keep them there, like a weird uncle.
That's true. Yeah, that's true.
Or
but
annoying
sister,
sibling.
It's the same for people in your life generally as well.
Why? Why can't you just remove a friend?
You can't. You can't just remove a friend. What do you want to do? Kill them? Like, what do you want to do?
Just cut ties with them. They no longer are part of your life.
No.
Like, what if the person approaches you?
You make it clear to them that you no longer want to be in each other's lives.
You have done that in the past, right? It happens sometimes, but sometimes you just can't.
Brother Hasnain, how often do you find yourself feeling that I wish there was so-and-so person in my life? You know, how often do you find yourself imagining up this character, this person, who has certain personalities, and you wish they were in your life?
Quite often, actually. Like, I always feel like, I always feel the need of having a person, like, who thinks like me. So, you know, I would be really comfortable with them. So... I quite often feel that.
Why do you think you need that person in your life? What are you lacking with what you already have?
You know, sometimes the times that people don't understand you. So you get sick, you know, staying around with those people.
True.
So I think like, oh, what if there was a person like who thinks like me and all? So he would understand me better. So that's the reason, I think.
Do you ever catch yourself thinking that?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
Do you guys do anything to find that person? So it's like in mysticism, in the school of mysticism, one of the prominent figures, we're not going to drop names here, but anyway, if his name were Ayatollah Qadhi, he would have said that if you spend half of your life looking for a mentor, then that's half of your life well spent. Right? Yeah, I like actively go out in pursuit of that person who would mentor you in the path of wayfaring, right?
Yeah.
So I'm saying that if you guys find the need in you to have a person that caters to certain, do you actively set out to find them?
No.
Why?
Because somehow you expect them to come into your life.
No.
That's one of the reasons. Second reason is like, you know, sometimes you feel, you cannot find someone like that.
Because you're a weirdo.
And let's face it, every time somebody has tried to see Imam Zaman, right? Every single time, pretty much, He gives the same answer. Don't do things to come and see me. Become such a person that I'll come and see you. I'll stuff bottle. I shouldn't do it in that voice because it sounds mocking, but I'm actually mocking ourselves right now. That, you know, what's wrong with us? You can. What are you searching for, man? You need to become something, and then it will come to you.
Ah, search inward rather than outward. Because I don't understand what you guys mean by I need someone. I feel like there's someone missing in my life, right? I personally just want to like remove more people, declutter. I don't mean that. I appreciate every single individual who exists in my life radius, and I wish to grow old with them.
Just in case they're listening.
Just in case they're listening. But
do you also, are you also looking someone like that?
No, I just said I'm not. I'm not at all. And what do you wish to gain? What do you wish to gain from finding this so-called mystery person?
Somebody.
Who would?
Who matters. Somebody who... I think it was one of the imams, anyway. He tells his three companions come to him, and he just says, Jim. Jim, that is it. Jim. Was it Jim?
The letter Jim?
Just the letter Jim. So they all understood it differently. One of them goes into the mountains. One of them does this. One of them does that. Then we had our brother, what's his name? The Bahlul.
Bahlul.
Mm-hmm. Bahlul. But anyway, he understood Majnoon from it, whatever it was, right?
Right.
So he feigned being crazy,
mm-hmm.
right? The Imam of the time gave them something, and from that they could understand something. Where is my Jim? That is all I want. Like, mm-hmm. I'm not even asking for a sentence. Just give me a Jim. Give me
Stopping
a letter.
Noise.
You know, I'll understand it. We don't even have that, sister. How can we not... Look, we are searching. Whether we admit it or not, we are searching for Imam Azaman. And there's a hadith that says that such a people will come at the end of times. So such a people will come at the end of the times where they will believe in me even though they haven't seen me, and they will believe in an Imam that they haven't seen.
Mm.
You know, that is... We, to an extent, alhamdulillah, are a type of miracle. And we're like the wish of Rasulullah. He looks into the distance and he just says salam. He's sitting with his companion, sister.
Mm.
He's sitting with his companions. Hello. He's surrounded by people. And he looks off into the distance and he says, assalamu alaik. Assalamu alaikum. His companions say, who are you saying salam to? And he says, I'm saying salam to those who will come at the end of times. They will believe in me even though they haven't seen me.
Yeah.
They're my brothers, he says. Okay, so if he's missing us from 1,400 years back, how can we not be missing him?
True.
We're definitely searching for something. And, you know, as childish and blasphemous as it might sound, it's not fair. We have been left completely alone. We're orphans.
We are.
Do you realize that?
Yeah.
Orphans.
That's why, like, إِنَّا نَشْكُوا إِلَيْكَ فَقْدَ نَبِيَنَا وَغَيْبَةَ وَلِيَنَا. Oh Allah, we lament to you, we complain to you, because... our prophet is deceased, our imam is hidden, and we are basically abandoned. But we're not. But coming back to the people that already exist in our lives, right? I think often people feel that if I were in a different situation, if I were a different person, or if I were surrounded by different people, my life would be different and better. I think we feel that a lot about, usually, again, our relatives and our spouse, because it's a very long-term sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like, if I had better parents, maybe I would have been more supportive parents, more understanding parents, I would have been more successful. Or if I...
had a different name. Some people blame their name as well.
Yeah, right? But I'm saying, why do you think that is, though? Why do you think they feel like had they been surrounded with different people,
uh-huh.
they would
yeah,
be...
Yeah, because that, they didn't get the right people. Right? Like, I have many friends that are not satisfied with their families.
Mm,
so, like,
sad.
There's envy, there's jealousy in the family members. They didn't get any good friends.
Mm.
So, of course, they'll feel the need to have had better people.
Mm.
Like, okay, so for me, my parents are supportive.
Mm.
So, I'm satisfied. So my friend, he doesn't have good parents. Like, what's the scene over there, but says that, like, his uncles and all, like, sometimes they envy him. There's a reason. So he said, like, he wishes to have better family.
That makes makes sense, but then to an extent you feel like, well, life's what you make of it. You can't constantly shift the blame on other people.
Mm.
It's very convenient.
Yeah, that's particularly about family, right?
Yeah.
Like, if it's a friend, you can just cut your ties with them.
Yeah.
And you can just make a new friend.
Yeah.
But if it's family, you have to live with them.
Yeah. Something else that I feel we do is that, okay, so a spouse or a close friend or a relative could have a certain nice quality. We don't notice it in them until we see it in another person who's a little farther away, and we, like, we dote on it, and we magnify it, mm-hmm. and we, like, raise that person up for being, for having that quality when someone right under our nose had that quality. Why is that that we do that?
Yeah, my mom had a fridge magnet or something. It said, you don't appreciate anybody until they're gone, you know. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah, she was a bit, she has a morbid sense of humor as well, but, yeah, I think that a lot, big part of it comes down to our lack of appreciation of who is around us. We need to learn to appreciate. Everybody has good and bad traits, and we need to...
We don't value anything until it's not around us.
Yeah, it's gone. It's gone. And I think, again, like, there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, annas harisun ala ma muni'. They are greedy, and they lust for something that, you know, they're forbidden to have. Like, when it's in your someone close to you, you're like, meh. But when it's someone far from you and you can't have them, and you're like, oh, wow, that's such an incredible quality to have. But then it all definitely comes down to deeper understanding and appreciation. Everyone has flaws. Everyone has imperfections. And life and growth is all about loving each other unconditionally. And that's all the time we have for today's episode, coincidentally. Thank you so very much, brothers. And thank you to our listeners for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي لدي أمة رايزك Let us see daylight again, once again.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
One police officer described how rioters attempted to gouge out his eyes and called him a traitor as they sought to invade the capital. Another told of being smashed in a doorway and nearly crushed amid a medieval battle with a pro-Trump mob as he heard guttural screams of pain from fellow police officers. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Luke Broadwater and Nicholas Vanders. The piece is titled, A Hitman Sent Them. Police at the Capitol recount the horrors of January 6th as the inquiry begins. Police officers described how rioters attempted to gouge out his eye and called him a traitor as they sought to invade the capital. Another told of being smashed in a doorway and nearly crushed amid a medieval battle with a pro-Trump mob as he heard guttural screams of pain from fellow police officers. A third said he was beaten unconscious and stunned repeatedly with a taser as he pleaded with his assailants, "I have kids." A fourth relayed how he was called a racist slur over and over again by intruders wearing Make America Great Again garb. All of them were telling us Trump sent us. Aquilino Gunnell, a U.S. Capitol Police sergeant, said on Tuesday as he tearfully recounted the horrors of defending Congress on 6th of January, testifying at the first hearing of a House Select Committee to investigate the attack. One by one, in excruciating detail, Sergeant Gunnell and three other police officers who faced off with the hordes that broke into the Capitol told Congress of the brutal violence, racism, and hostility they suffered as a throng of angry rioters acting in the name of former President Donald J. Trump beat, crushed, and shocked them. More than 6 months after the assault, the accounts of the four uniformed police officers, as precise as they were cinematic, cut through a fog of confusion, false equivalence, and misdirection that Republicans have generated to try to insulate themselves politically and placate Donald Trump. They provided a set of gripping first-person narratives that brought home the harrowing events of 6th of January, when Donald Trump's supporters, urged on by his lie of a stolen election, stormed the Capitol to disrupt the official counting of electoral votes to formalize President Joe Biden's victory. House Republican leaders who have opposed efforts to investigate the assault boycotted the inquiry and dismissed it as a partisan ploy. So they were absent as the police officers relived their trauma in a Capitol Hill hearing room. "This nigger voted for Joe Biden," Officer Harry Dunn of the Capitol Police told the panel a rioter had screamed at him, prompting a crowd to turn on him. Later, Police Officer Dunn begged the lawmakers leading the inquiry to uncover the full extent of Donald Trump's role. "There was an attack on 6th of January and a hitman sent them," he said. "I want you to get to the bottom of that." Representative Liz Cheney of Wyoming, a leading critic of Donald Trump and one of two Republicans named by Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi to serve on the panel, used the proceedings to chastise her GOP colleagues for refusing to investigate the worst attack on Congress in centuries. "Will we be so blinded by partisanship that we throw away the miracle of America?" Liz Cheney demanded. "Do we hate our political adversaries more than we love our country and revere our Constitution?" The two top congressional Republicans, however, later said they had been too busy with other work to watch. The testimony punctuated by video montages of the rampage, including some footage from the body cameras of police officers who testified, was a riveting reminder of the brutal reality of the day. In the hearing room and across Capitol Hill, officers, lawmakers, and aides who lived through the riot were glued to cell phone or television screens watching it unfold. A violent mob was pointed toward the Capitol and told to win a trial by combat, Representative Benny Thompson, Democrat of Mississippi, and the chairman of the panel, said as he opened the session. Some descended on the city with clear plans to disrupt our democracy. One writer said that they weren't there to commit violence, but that, and I'm quoting, "we were just there to overthrow the government," unquote. The refusal by most Republicans to participate in the hearing was just the latest indication of how a party that portrays itself as a champion of law enforcement has worked to thwart attempts to investigate the attack. "We still don't know exactly what happened," said Representative Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, the other Republican afforded a seat on the panel by Nancy Pelosi. "Why? Because many in my party have treated this as just another partisan fight. It's toxic, and it's a disservice to the police officers' families." Fearing its political implications for their party, Republicans succeeded in blocking the creation of an independent, bipartisan panel in the style of the 9/11 Commission to handle the inquiry, and fiercely opposed the creation of the Select Committee. Then, after Nancy Pelosi refused to seat two Trump allies put forward by Republicans, both of whom had amplified the former president's false claims of election fraud and disparaged the inquiry, the House Republican leader, Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, said his members would simply not participate in the panel. Instead, Kevin McCarthy called his own event in the shadow of the Capitol before the hearing to try to preempt the officer's testimony and divert blame for the assault onto Democrats. Ignoring those who organized, encouraged, and carried out the attack, he and other Republicans faltered Nancy Pelosi, who on 6th of January was forced to flee the Capitol as armed members of the mob roamed the corridors calling out, "Where are you, Nancy?" Nancy Pelosi bears responsibility as Speaker of the House for the tragedy that occurred on 6th of January, said Representative Elise Stefanik of New York. Stefanik became the House No. 3 Republican when the party ousted Liz Cheney from the position for speaking out against former President Donald Trump. Congressional leaders hired the law enforcement personnel responsible for Capitol security, but are typically not involved in day-to-day decisions about security protocols. Security at the Capitol is controlled by the Capitol Police Board, which includes the House and Senate Sergeant-at-Arms and the architect of the Capitol. While the hearing was underway, senators announced that they had reached a bipartisan deal on a supplemental spending bill to repay the National Guard for its deployment costs, pump $100 million into the embattled Capitol Police, and allocate another $300 million to harden defenses at the Capitol. Even as the police officers testified about having been brutalized by the rioters, a group of far-right Republicans was publicly siding with those who breached the Capitol. Representatives Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, Matt Gaetz of Florida, Paul Gosar of Arizona, and Louis Gohmert of Texas held a news conference outside the Justice Department to object to the treatment of the rioters charged in connection with the attack, calling them 6th of January prisoners who had been mistreated because of their political beliefs. Both Kevin McCarthy and Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the top Senate Republican, said they had not watched the hearing. Pressed to address those within his party seeking to deny or distort the attack, Kevin McConnell, Mary pointed back to comments he made last winter, shortly after orchestrating Donald Trump's impeachment acquittal on the charge that he incited an insurrection, when he said Donald Trump was practically and morally responsible for it. "I don't see how I could have expressed myself more forthrightly than I did on that occasion, and I stand by everything I said," said Mitch McConnell, who later led the Republican effort to block an independent, bipartisan investigation of the riot. Senator John Thune of South Dakota, the number two Senate Republican, called the police officers heroes and said, "We should listen to what they have to say." Like Mitch McConnell, John Thune helped marshal Republican opposition to the investigation. The only two Republicans who appeared eager to answers about the assault were Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney, who greeted the police officers warmly in the hearing room, gripping their hands and embracing them. Liz Cheney said the panel should move quickly to issue subpoenas to uncover any potential ties between the rioters and the Trump administration and the Trump campaign. Lawmakers must learn what happened every minute of that day in the White House, every phone call, every conversation, every meeting leading up to, during and after the attack, she said. After the hearing, Mr. Thompson said that subpoenas would be issued soon and that another hearing could come within weeks. But on Tuesday, the focus was on the nightmare experienced by the police officers who responded on that day. Michael Fanone, a Washington police officer who was beaten unconscious and subjected to repeated shocks with his own taser by the mob, suffering a heart attack and a brain injury, said he heard rioters calling for him to be killed with his own gun. Lawmakers played Officer Fanone's body camera video in which he could be heard pleading for mercy. "I have kids," he muttered, before being carried off by fellow police officers and losing consciousness. "I feel like I went to hell and back to protect them and the people in this room," police officer Fanone said. "But too many are now telling me that hell doesn't exist or that hell wasn't actually that bad. The indifference shown to my colleagues is disgraceful," he added, his voice rising to a shout as he pounded the witness table in anger. Sergeant Gunnell said what he went through on Capitol Hill on that day had been more fearsome than any experience patrolling bomb-infested roads during an army deployment in Iraq, denouncing what he called a continuous shocking attempt to ignore or try to destroy the truth of what truly happened.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.